Welcome to Don't Pass Me By on the Shake and Wake Network with me, your host, Bob Wilson. Today we have two excellent guests. Who are they, you say? Why? Jude Sutherland Kessler, our old friend, author of the esteemed John Lennon series. Jude has brought along a friend, someone we've wanted to talk to, and we couldn't be happier that he's here. It's Jay Bergen, who said, "Do not call me Mr. Bergen, so I will call him Jay or Mr. Jay." He has written an excellent book called Lennon, the Mobster, and the Lawyer. It has a foreword by the esteemed Bob Gruen, and it is on DeVault Graves Books. Welcome, you two crazy kids.
Hey, how is everyone?
Good. Excellent. That's fine. How are you and Jude, Bob?
I couldn't be happier to have you on the show and your excellent book, and Jude Kessler to boot. And we have our producer, Steve, is here, so the gang's all here, and we're ready to rock and roll. So, Jude, what say I hand this over to you? Like they start off, I saw her standing there. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's off to you.
It's 1, 2, 3, 4, isn't it? Well,
yes.
2, 3, 5. Well, we are so, 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 so lucky. Everyone listening, buckle your seat belts, or as they say in Liverpool, your safety belts. Because, listen, we have lots of people come on our various podcasts who are esteemed authors and have done research and really know the Beatles. But it is a rare delight when we get to have a primary source, a member of the Beatles family, a member of the Beatles entourage or friends. And today we are really, really blessed. And I mean that because we are going to be speaking with, first of all, I mean, before we even get to John Lennon, an extremely respected, successful New York attorney from the Park Avenue firm of Marshall, Bratter, Green, Allison, and Tucker, who during his career, and you know they always say an illustrious career, I would call this more an illustrated and illustrious career because he did say very colorful things. For example, he represented the New York Yankees and the Cleveland Indians, the Cincinnati Reds, and the San Francisco Giants in their Major League Baseball arbitration for salaries back when all of that was going on. And I have a feeling that he knows a little bit more about the New York Yankees than he's willing to put into print yet, but that might be another book for another day. He also represented Albert Grossman between the arbitration between Bob Dylan and Albert Grossman. There was a trial between the star and his former manager, and we might get him to tell us a little bit about that as well. And he also represented Terry Knight, who was the founder and sometime manager of Grand Funk Railroad, in litigation between Knight and the band. So he has done some amazing things. So it's no surprise that on the 3rd of February, 1975, he was given a very interesting case between Morris Levy and John Lennon. And so he took all of the experience that he had in antitrust litigation, securities litigation, entertainment, trademark, copyrights, and he put it to work in this case representing John Lennon. And the book that he wrote about it, Lennon, the Mobster, and the Lawyer, is truly a book that does not repeat the same old stories you've heard 1,000 times. This is brand new material. It is excellent. And we are so honored to have with us Jay Bergen. Welcome again, Jay.
Thank you very much, Jude. I appreciate it. I appreciate particularly this the long buildup to giving me the opportunity to say it's really a thrill to be on with you and Bob. And I'm looking forward to discussing whatever we feel like discussing tonight.
All right. I love it. Well, you know, I remember the night, summer night, that I was outside, had my phone in hand, I was watering plants, and I clicked on Messenger, Facebook Messenger, and there was a message in there from a person who has now become a dear friend of mine, Scott McKinley, who said, "I've just done an audio book from an attorney who represented John Lennon. It's named Lennon, the Mobster, and the Lawyer. I'm sending you a complimentary audio file. Will you take a listen?" And I get lots of things like that about John. And sometimes they're good, sometimes they're ho-hum. But I thought, okay, I'll give this a try. And within an hour, I was your number one fan. It was like those guys in the San Francisco Gold Rush who were paying for gold, that most of them, you know, found nothing. And some of them found huge nuggets of gold. And I was running around going, oh, my goodness, oh, my goodness. You, literally, eureka, because the stuff that you have in there is so new. It is really and truly a pearl of great price, because for linen people who've done research for years and years and years, it's all new material. So if you don't mind, just take us back and tell us what it was that convinced you. I think the trial took place in 75, and you published the book in 2021. So I'm not good at math, but I think that means that 46 years went by in the intervening period. What convinced you to sit down and write this story?
Well, you know, I had been carrying around since the trial, and actually the case began in 75, but we finally got to trial in January of 1976. But anyhow, I had been carrying around in five or six banker's boxes through about five different house moves over that four-decade period, all of the files that I had on the case, about 10,000 pages of trial testimony, and the entire appellate record after we won in the court, in the trial court, and then Morris Levy appealed. I also had a number of Beatles and John Lennon record albums that we had used as exhibits to show the care that John and the Beatles put into their album covers. And I'd been wondering, and this included a move from New York City, the New York City area where I had lived most of my life, down to where I am now in North Carolina. And I had these boxes stored out in a garage, in a storeroom in back of the garage. And one day, it was about 5 years ago in May or April, I was trying to think of, what am I going to do with these things? I don't know what made me start thinking about them, because I had, Jude and Bob, I had never looked at them. I had never opened those boxes and looked at them in that whole period. They were just always with me. I don't know whether it was because of the connection with John I had, but they were always there. And so I went out to the garage, and I was thinking, well, maybe I'll donate them to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I sat down on one of the boxes, opened up another, took out some of John's testimony, just random, and started reading it, and I realized that there was a terrific story here that had not been told, because this case kind of flew under the radar in 1975, and particularly at the time of the trial in 1976, and there was very little written about it. There were a couple of articles in Rolling Stone, but nobody had told the story, not only about the trial, but about who John Lennon was at this period in his life, 1975 to 77, the beginning of the period when he dropped out of the music business. And he and Yoko had gotten back together after their 18-month separation in 73 and 74. And I just thought there's a story here that has to be told, because John Lennon fans and Beatles fans and music fans, rock and roll fans generally, will find a lot of this interesting, particularly if I use judiciously some of John's testimony, which was excellent and laid out how he and the Beatles, as he said, when I started questioning them, how they, quote, learned the trade, close quote. So right. that was the genesis of the book. And it took me from then until I finally got a publishing deal in November of 2021. And the book was officially published, although it was up on Amazon in January of 2022, this year. It was officially published on May 1st.
Well, it is amazing. And kudos also to Scott McKinley, who reads the audiobook, because it is so hard for me, because Scott's voice was your voice for so long. And when I met you, I'm like, wait a minute, he doesn't sound exactly like Scott. But you really, he brought the book to life, and he's so good at doing John's voice as well. And I have listened to the audiobook 3 times, and I have read the book from cover to cover 2x. That's how good it is. It's so excellent.
Scott McKinley did a terrific job. He really, you know, Tom Graves, the publisher, was much more experienced than I was in terms of picking somebody. But to do the Audible book, because we wanted to do one right from the beginning, and we auditioned a couple of people, and actually Tom Graves, the publisher, auditioned a couple of people, and then he decided, look, I think you ought to listen to this Scott McKinley. And I thought he was good, and then Scott went ahead and did it, and then Tom and I listened to it and made a couple of corrections here and there in terms of pronunciations. And that was it.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And I would recommend to people who are going to get the book, listen first, listen to the audio file first, get your book, get your physical book, and then go back and make notes in your physical book. And, you know, really, you got to hear this several times because it's amazing. And what I was thinking about just a few minutes ago as we were preparing for the show is, from the very first moment that you met John, the very first comment that he ever said to you about, I don't make bargains, I don't make business deals. And it was such a straightforward answer. I thought Aunt Mimi would have been so proud of this little boy, because from day one, you could see that he is a truth teller. He is simply telling the truth. So let's go back to February of 75, which I believe it was, when you come into the office, no idea that you're going to get this case, and you first hear about John Lennon's countersuit, or his suit with Morris Levy. Were you already a Beatles fan at that point?
Oh, yes. Because when I was in high school, I graduated from high school on Long Island in 1955. So when I was in high school, you know, 53, 54, I listened to Alan Freed, who was the DJ who came to New York from Cleveland, claimed he coined the phrase rock and roll. But he had a show 5 nights a week, and I listened. I had a friend of mine named Andy Moan in high school who recommended that I listen to it. And I think one of the first songs I heard on Alan Freed's show was Earth Angel by the Penguins. And I went to some of the shows that Alan Freed had at the Brooklyn Paramount. And when the Beatles came out, I had just graduated from law school in 62, and I love them. And I remember my first wife and I lived in Brooklyn, and we went to see A Hard Day's Night, and we were walking home to our apartment, and I said, oh, boy, these guys are for real. That was a very, very clever movie, very funny. And so I was a fan right from the beginning.
Well, you were present at what I consider to be the highlight of the Beatles' career. I mean, I think a lot of people would say it's Shea Stadium, and Shea Stadium is without a doubt a great moment. But no moment, in my opinion, is as dramatic as the night that you witnessed in Forest Hills Tennis Stadium. Tell us what that was like.
Well, you know, it was funny at this time. There weren't these, you know, big arena shows. And somehow I heard that the Beatles were going to be at Forest Hills, and that there was a store. And I think it was kind of like a candy store up, with a soda fountain and everything, where they were selling tickets on Queens Boulevard. And I was living at home with my I was married by then. I'm sorry. This is seven. Yeah. I was married, but I borrowed my parents' car and drove into the store and bought two tickets for one of the two nights they were going to be at Forest Hills. And I think the tickets were like $4 or $5, something like that.
Yep.
And my wife, Betty, and I went to the show, the first show, and the Beatles landed in a helicopter on one of the back tennis courts, because this is where the old U.S. Open used to be played. And I'll give you an idea of how tennis has grown, and so has rock and roll, but there were only about 16,000 people there that night. The floor of the tennis floor, which was the main court, was covered with police sawhorses, and so nobody could get onto the floor. But somehow, after the show started and was going for a while, a young woman, a teenager, got onto the stage, and she ran right by John and Paul and grabbed George Harrison around the waist from behind him. And Harrison kept playing and laughing while the security guards and a couple of policemen were trying to pry this young lady off his back. But it was quite a night. It was a beautiful night in August. And that was either the first night. I think it was the first night of the two nights that they played at Forest Hills. And it was electrifying. Yeah.
It was that image of the helicopter circling as it lands, and it's coming down very dramatically and very slowly, and it's circling and it's circling and it's getting lower and lower. And the Beatles are looking down to thousands of faces looking up at them and flashbulbs constantly flashing. And I'll never forget the image of them. It says descending like gods from the sky, and you can just see this image of these young men landing very slowly, and the screams and the flash bulbs, and of course the Righteous Brothers standing helpless and hopeless on stage because no one is listening to them at all. And you know, it is that moment that Brian Epstein always longed for when he first saw them in the Cavern Club. And there is no other night to me that's as dramatic. I mean, you were there for the night of nights. That was some event. Do you remember them descending in that helicopter?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. As they, you know, I mean, everybody got there early and, you know, for the show. And they came down, and the Forest Hills was a very fancy tennis club. So there were all these back tennis courts aside from the, you know, the main arena where they would play the finals of the U.S. Open.
Yep.
Before 16,000. Now they play them before, I don't know, 25,000, 26,000. Yeah, I remember them coming down. Yeah, absolutely.
An amazing night. That was
because of the traffic.
Yeah, right. And that's why they made them come in the helicopter, because they were so afraid that if they let them come through the tunnel, that fans would barricade the tunnel and they'd be stuck in there and it would be a death trap, you know, which I can see that happening. I really can. So fast forward from that August night in 1964 to 1975, and you go into work and you hear that you're going to be managing this case with John Lennon. Was this an exciting prospect for you? And how did you get the case?
Well, my client, my senior partner, David Dalgenes, was a real estate and business lawyer, and he had been hired right after John, Paul, and Ringo left Alan Klein in 1973 to negotiate and represent John in terms of the dissolution of the Beatles partnership. And I had handled a couple of really minor John Lennon matters at the time. John and Yoko did one of Yoko's avant-garde appearances for public television, and uh, it consisted of John jumping off a 6-foot ladder. And he invited the audience, members of the audience, to come up and so you could fly. This was Yoko's version of how you can fly. And one of the people who climbed up there fell off and sued John later on for damages. So I was handling that really minor matter. And that morning, February 3rd, I had heard rumors about this possible bootleg John Lennon album that was coming out. And I told David Dalgenes that if that happens, I want to be involved. And I had already handled the Terry Knight, Graham Funk litigation right after I joined the firm in 1972. And so I had a reputation at that point. And so he called me and he asked me to come down to his office and he handed me this letter, a January 9th, 1975 letter from Morris Levy to David, claiming that John Lennon had agreed to give Morris the worldwide television marketing rights to this album of rock and roll oldies that he was going to do. And David handed me the letter and he said, look, can you go to a meeting this afternoon with Capital's lawyers at their offices where this is going to be discussed? And I said, yeah, sure. So I walked over to Capital's office. It was about 5 o'clock and met these three in-house lawyers, one from Los Angeles. And they started giving me some of the background about, you know, they had been hearing these rumors and that Levy was about to start advertising on TV, was buying time to market this album. And as we were talking, the door to the conference room opened and John Lennon walked in. Now, okay. I had no idea he was going to be there. I don't know whether the Capitol lawyers did. And I was momentarily stunned. John came in. We all introduced ourselves. He was dressed as he usually is when I was with him, where he looked like, you know, he was almost like he was wearing clothes that he bought at the Salvation Army or something like that. And of course, we're all in our uniforms, you know, the suit, the tie, the polished shoes and, you know, the whole route. And we started talking and I started questioning him about, you know, what's the story with this bootleg album. And he finally, as in the course of explaining it to us, he told us that he had given Morris Levy back in November of 1974 a rough mix of the album. And, you know, the beginning of the story really is that Levy brought one of his bogus copyright infringement cases against the Beatles' two publishing companies in 1970, claiming that the song Come Together that John had written, the first single on Abbey Road, infringed the copyright of You Can't Catch Me, the Chuck Berry hit, which Morris Levy's publishing company, Big Seven, owned the rights to. And in late 1973, when the case was about to come to trial, John is explaining this to us, he was out in Los Angeles just beginning to record the rock and roll album with Phil Spector. And he did not want to come back to New York. He said, I'm already working, you know, go and settle it. And the settlement that was made was that on his next album, which everybody anticipated would be the rock and roll album, since he was working on it, he would record three songs owned by Morris Levy's publishing company, and one of them had to be You Can't Catch Me. Mm-hmm. So the problem was that in late December of 1973, Phil Spector flipped out, had been taking home the master tapes every night from the recording studio, the A&M studio in Los Angeles, and John couldn't finish the album. And in the meantime, he wrote some other songs. They were trying to get the tapes back from Phil, and couldn't. Capitol was trying, John was trying. And finally, John wrote a number of songs and took a band, a group of session musicians that he had played with before, into the recording studio, the Record Plant in New York, and was going to make an album because he never thought he was going to get the Spector tapes back. That album turned out to be Walls and Bridges. And just before he started the recording, all of a sudden, 28 boxes of the master tapes came back because Capitol had been able to do a deal with Morris. But John, after listening to some of the sessions, some of the tapes, realized he could not do any work on them now. It was going to take too much work, and he just went ahead, finished the Walls and Bridges album. It came out, and when it came out, Morris Levy started jumping up and down saying, you know, where are my songs? Where are my songs?
Right.
So that led to a meeting with Morris. And it was at that meeting that the possibility, this was in October of 74, that the possibility of John releasing this album on TV was discussed. But everybody knew, and Morris was told, I have to get EMI's permission. EMI has the exclusive rights. So,
right.
So that's where we were when we were sitting there in this conference room at Capitol. Capitol asked if I thought we could get an injunction stopping Morris, and I said, I think that's a mistake. We may not get an injunction, and I think the problem with filing the first shot in a piece of litigation is that you lose control. You don't know what's going to happen next. And John said, look, I said to him, how long will it take to finish the album? He said, 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
I said to Capitol's lawyers, what about that? And John said, look, I want to finish it now because this has been the longest album I've ever worked on. I'm really tired of it. I think he actually said, I'm sick of it. And I want to get it done. And that's what happened. He finished the album in 2 days. We shipped to Capitol. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's amazing. I was just saying, I'm looking at you at the thing here. He said, I'm tired and sick of it. And we always say, I'm sick and tired of it, right? But he said it just inverted. I'm tired and sick of it, which I thought was interesting.
Well, and he had just finished, not too long before that, the Walls and Bridges album, and he had been trying to promote that. And now, all of a sudden, he had started work in October of 74, just 3 months before this meeting, 4 months before the meeting. And what he realized was that he couldn't use all of the tapes, so he had to get the same band in from Walls and Bridges and record some new versions. There were some of the tracks from Phil Spector he could use, some of them he couldn't. So he was really, John was at that point, he was really tired. I mean, I think physically and emotionally tired. He had that terrible time, the lost weekend, as he described it, in Los Angeles. I think he was just about to get back with Yoko, and that's what he wanted to do.
Yeah. Well, I love that John never could remember lyrics. When he would, at some points in his early career, he would write lyrics on his hand. And of course, on the rooftop concert, he had a poster made up and somebody was holding words for him to some of the songs they were singing on the rooftop. Well, he meets you in this meeting. You give him this wonderful advice that you want him to finish the album. And if he can do it in 2 days, wonderful. And he takes your advice. And then you get into the elevator. And what happens when you get into the elevator?
Well, of course, we had all introduced each other and shook hands in the conference room. And we get in the elevator. And, of course, he looks at me, just the two of us, because the other lawyers were staying in the conference room, and he said, "Are you one of the lawyers?" I said, "Yes," because John, you know, I think it's pretty widely known that John did not like spending time with lawyers or accountants or business people. That was not, as he said sometime during the his testimony, that's not my job. My job is, right. is to write the songs and record them. And I said, yes, but don't hold that against me. And he laughed. And we went out into onto the side street. I think it was 55th Street and 6th Avenue there where Capitol's lawyer, Capitol's offices were. And he said, I'm going home. Good night. And I have a pretty strong feeling that that was the first night that John went back to the Dakota.
Yeah. Several things struck me about that scene. Number one, you're also, besides being a wonderful attorney, you're a great writer. And this is what you wrote. When he said to you, are you one of the lawyers? You wrote, he doesn't remember who I am, I thought. But he will as we get to know each other. I love that. And then you conclude that paragraph that chapter with this. Unbeknownst to me, and even more astonishing, was the friendship the two of us would develop. John, the 34-year-old rock icon, and Jay, the 37-year-old button-down, just the facts, ma'am, lawyer. I could not have fathomed that night where my representation of John Lennon would take me. And that is just, that's one of those moments where I have to blink my eyes and gulp. It was beautiful, really beautiful.
Well, thank you, but that's really the way I felt.
It's just amazing, amazing. Well, you've told us a little bit about the Morris Levy case, and we understand that Morris is going to take these tapes that really, he kind of coerced those tapes. He kind of badgered John for those tapes, and he's going to make this this bootleg. Is there anything for people that don't know about the case that you want to add to that to help them understand what was going on?
Yeah, I one of the things I learned about John and spending time with him, he did not like saying no to people. And he was very shy. And, you know, Morris was just badgering him. I want to hear my songs. And, you know, John made the mistake of giving him this rough mix. And the rough mix contained two songs, Angel Baby and Be My Baby. Now, John testified that Angel Baby was one of his all-time favorite songs. And right. He hated cutting it. When he went in those next 2 days, one of the last things he did was to cut those two songs for two reasons. One, the band in both of those songs were playing in a different tune that John was singing. It sounded awful. And also, those two songs made what turned out to be the John Lennon rock and roll album, the Capitol album, too long, because John testified that he did not want either side of an album to be more than 20 minutes, because if it was more than 20 minutes, you started losing the strength of the sound. And he wanted all of his records to be loud. But as you got to the middle of each side, the sound kind of faded. So those two songs were not on the rock and roll album. Morris Levy left them on the Roots album.
Right. Interesting. So interesting. Well, this is my last question, and then I'm going to turn it over to Sir Bob. But at the point that you met John at that very first meeting and you walk out onto the street together, did you have any idea at that point that it would end up where John would come to court almost every day and that he would be such a constant presence and such an active witness in the trial? Was this something you anticipated, or did it just happen that way?
I never thought of it. I never thought of it. John and I never discussed it. I made it very clear to him that he was going to be one of the key witnesses, because he was the one who was going to have to tell the story to counter whatever, what I believe would be a fabricated story that Morris Levy would tell. But the night before the trial started, I was staying in a hotel, the Drake Hotel in New York City, because I lived way out in New Jersey and it was too far to commute every day. And I told John where I was going to be. And, you know, I said, if anything comes up, you know, call me, because I had seen him just a few days before up at the Dakota. And about midnight, the phone rang and it was John. And he said, Jay, can Yoko come to the trial? And I said, oh, yeah, of course. I said, I'm sorry. I would have invited her if I'd known she was interested, because at this point, Sean was about 3 months old. He had been born October 9th, in like just 1975. So it was, I thought maybe she wouldn't be interested. I said, absolutely. You know, she's welcome. And the next day they showed up in their limo, picked me up. They came up to the office for a while. We talked about what was going to happen on the first day. And I always tried to keep John really aware of what was going to happen in the courtroom, because I had a feeling that this was going to be all new to him. But so down we went to the courthouse, and they came every day, the two of them, for 20 days.
Wow.
And there were a number of days when John did not have to testify, so he didn't have to be there. But I think he realized that it was important that he show the court that he and Yoko, but he principally was really interested in this case. He was defending it, and he was going to defend it all the way.
Wow. That's just, it's incredible. And that, of course, kicks off the next portion of the book, which is the trial and testimony and so forth. So, Bob, I'm going to hand it over to you and take it away, sir.
Well, let it out and let it in. Hey, Jude, I'll begin with my questions for Mr. Jay Bergen. She was worried we were going to have to sing on today's show, so I thought I would sneak some singing in, or attempted singing there. Back to my questions.
I'll sing.
Yeah, go ahead.
You don't want to hear me sing.
We do. No other show will have this. This is a great opportunity for us here at Don't Pass Me By. You have the mic, sir.
Okay.
How about a Ringo song? You'd like to be under the sea. In Octopus's Garden. Take it away, Jim.
Take it away. Under the Octopus's Garden. I like, my favorite John Lennon song is Help.
I needed some help with my singing, so jump in there and help.
If I had had a couple of gin and tonics, I'd be singing, but I haven't had any yet.
They misdelivered them to me. That's why I was singing. They came over with my pizza. But back to the most interesting stuff here, the book, Jay.
Right.
One of the most interesting parts of the book for me, and I believe also for my good friend Jude, I think was, John's testimony when he spoke of always having an active hand in the production of his own records. And even back at EMI with George Martin producing, he even got in on that stuff. So he cared very much about the records. Tell us, if you would, some of the things John shared in court regarding his crucial input to the making of all these records and how special that might have made them.
Well, I think he and the other Beatles really cared about, the quality of the records. And as he testified in court, over a period of the first two or three albums, EMI in England would try and get them to sing other people's songs. and they kept insisting. He said, "I think he said we were arrogant enough to resist that, and we wanted to play our own songs." And gradually, over those first two or three albums, they, according to John's testimony, they took over step by step the control of the albums, including getting to the album covers. And John testified that, you know, with a lot of artists, the record company would say, okay, show up on such and such a day. There'll be a photographer there, and he's going to shoot a picture of you, and you know, that's it. But they didn't want that. And I think he testified that Revolver was the first one. No, Rubber Soul. I'm sorry. Rubber Soul was the first one that they really got control of the album cover. He also testified that it was Klaus Voormann who he asked to design the cover for Revolver, because Klaus was not only a trained artist, but he was also and a musician, but he was also an excellent graphic artist. And he designed the Revolver cover. And as we all know, that year, that album cover won the Grammy for the best graphic design for an album cover.
That's pretty sad.
When John talked about his own albums, after he explained that about when he and the Beatles were working on albums together, he explained how, you know, he would get the musicians and he would take them into the studio and teach them each one of the songs. And he went into detail, Bob and Jude, explaining that since he, and I think another thing we all know, that none of the Beatles could read or write music, that he would sit down with an arranger and explain to him and play for him how what this song was going to sound like. And the arranger would write up the music so that the other musicians could learn what it was like, what the song would sound like. And he would take them into the studio and teach them the songs. And one of his funny lines was that after he would, you know, kind of do the initial take of the song, he said, he would say to the musicians, "Does anybody have any secrets? Does anybody have any secrets they haven't told me?" In other words, saying to them, did you play a bad note?
Uh-huh.
The other thing that he mentioned in detail was that each day when they would come in to record for the next day, the studio technicians, the engineers would have to kind of reset everything, because he said people would come in and they'd move some of they'd move the drums or they'd move some of the chairs or everything, and they'd have to get everything looking like and back where it was the night before. And that's why he didn't like a lot of distractions. He wanted to keep the music, the musicians, focused. And I think that album, the basic tracks, they recorded on October 20th, started on October 21st, 1974. And I think they finished them on Friday, the 25th. And he then explained in detail about how after he got the basic tracks down, then he would decide what else he wanted to add, you know, a saxophone or, you know, other instruments. Maybe they'd bring in a string section to play on some of the tracks. So he went into pretty careful detail, Bob, about how he handled each one of these solo albums.
Now, With when I think of the Beatles, you know, second half of their career and beginning of John's solo career, I mean, he really was in court many times. I mean, they had, you know, the litigations with Apple and with Alan Klein, their, you know, later manager who Paul wasn't thrilled with. He had also his immigration case. He was in court like quite a bit. Could you talk about what type of a witness he was on the stand? I know I tie into it. You said when he came into the informal meeting, he was wearing the clothes that looked like they came from the Salvation Army. What was he like when he came into the courtroom? What was he wearing? And I know he could be a charming fellow. He was very intelligent. But what was your opinion of John as a witness on the stand?
Well, I think he was the best witness I ever had. And that covers a lot of a lot of territory,
witnesses.
A lot of cases.
Yeah.
I don't think he had testified that much before in a courtroom. The Klein case never really went to a courtroom, but I know he had testified in depositions in that case, because I actually went to attend several of the days of the deposition when they were taken in New York shortly. I think it was in April, right after I met him the first time. My partner, David Dalgin, said, why don't you go? Somebody else was representing each one of the Beatles George, Ringo, and John in the Klein case. So I went along just to observe what was happening, but he was an excellent witness. We spent a lot of time before Morris's lawyers took his deposition. That was in early May of 1975, and also before his actual trial testimony, going over what the facts were, because I think the most important part of a case, of a trial, are the facts. I know people talk a lot about the law, but I really think you have to get the facts straight first. And then worry about the law later on, because since Morris was claiming that this was an oral agreement that he made with John, there was nothing in writing. And Morris actually testified on his deposition when I took his deposition, that they didn't anticipate there being a writing. So this was all, you know, John's testimony and Morris's testimony about what was said at that meeting in October of 1974. And John was very good at articulating the facts and his position. And he never really forgot what we talked about. He also had a terrific sense of humor, and he would not let anybody push him around. Morris's lawyer tried to push him a couple of times, and he wouldn't lose his temper or anything, but he was really, he would just assert himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, they always called John acerbic. Was he acerbic? I learned that word because John always used it, so I looked in my dictionary to figure out what acerbic was.
Well, he could be nice and you know, kind of very be acerbic and sarcastic and kind of stick the knife in you. But I just opened the book up, and I was looking at where I wrote, "For all who admire John Winston Ono Lennon." And Morris's lawyer, John was testifying about how he knew that the public was not happy with the Roots album. And Levy's lawyer objected and said, "Well, how does Mr. Lennon know what the public was feeling about the album?" And John said, "I am qualified." I quoted this right on the second page of the book. "I am qualified to tell the court how the public was confused by the bootleg Roots album. I met the public who talked to me about my product. I met a taxi driver who said, 'Sorry, I already bought the wrong one.' That is the public. They talk to me on the street. I know what they are thinking. I don't live in some ivory tower. I walk the streets. I get in taxi cabs, and I know what they think." And that kind of shut down that whole argument. And that was right. When at the times I spent with John, where we'd go out to lunch or walk the streets, you know, people would approach him. They'd ask for autographs. And his rule was, I'll give anybody an autograph as long as I'm not eating. So
if he was eating, you were out of luck. But
you had to wait till he finished.
No. The first day of his deposition, we got down onto Madison Avenue. We were at Morris Levy's lawyer, his office, and I said, "Let's go to lunch in the Grand Central Station." And I wanted to take him to the Oyster Bar, which was a famous restaurant in the station at that time. And he said, "Oh, well, I've never been in Grand Central Station." I said, "Well," knowing that he was an art student, I said, "Well, you're in for a real treat then." And we walked in off Vanderbilt Avenue, which is on the north, the west side of the station, and onto this balcony looking down onto the floor and this spectacular room that is the main room of the station, where the ticket booths are, the information booth. And he was really knocked out. But to cut to where we went into the restaurant, John said, he whispered to me, "Ask the maitre d' if we can sit against the wall." So I asked, maitre d' took us over to the south side of the room. And John said, "You sit with your back to the wall so that I'm facing you and I'm not facing the crowd, the people who were having lunch." And the Oyster Bar was a famous seafood restaurant in New York at the time. And almost as soon as we sat down, I think it was two of the, not the waiters, but the busboys came over and asked for an autograph. And he said to them very politely, "Not now. When I'm finished eating, I'll give you an autograph." And he did.
Well, that was pretty kind of him to do that. When they asked him about the public, did he say something like, "You know, I don't live in an ivory tower. I go out among the people in New York City. You know, when I get in a cab, I don't slide the glass over. You know, I'm happy to talk to them, love. That's why I came to New York in the first place, because I wanted to see people, you know. So I find it a little insulting that you'd be telling me I'm not speaking to people about my own record, because I know about my own record, you know, love. So let's get that
straight." Scott McKinley, watch out.
Yeah, boy, we should have gotten you to do John's accent.
If you write a second book, I'm available. Just drop me a message. You know, I'll try. For you, I'd do it in a second.
Now I know where you are. Yes, I can do that.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this, but you were talking about the Queens Boulevard, love. And that's, you know, when I went to school in New York City, my friend Bob Wilson, you know, he grew up in Queens and he walked home along Queens Boulevard to save the bus fare so he could buy Beatles records. Did you know that, Luke?
That
is good, Jay.
Very good. Very good.
It's the truth.
I didn't know you could do that, Bob.
I didn't either. I never gave it a shot before, but I figured, what the hey, we could always edit it out if it's...
Oh, you've been probably rehearsing all day. Oh, come on.
I started yesterday, you know, yesterday and today, just like the album cover, you know. You know, when we all got together because they banned the record, you know, because we had pictures, we were protesting. We weren't doing a sick thing about babies, you know. We were trying to protest war. You know, so we had an anti-war record there. So, you know, it started all the way back then, you know, and they made us redo that photo shoot. But as you see in Jude Kessler's book, she'll tell you that really it wasn't an ugly thing. It was an anti-war thing.
I believe that John always said, "My beloved friend, Jude Kessler."
I agree. Please remember that you two are still under oath, even though we've been on for a while. Now that other fellow, Morris Levy, he wanted to release his own record from the raw tapes that were recorded to make this rock and roll LP that we've been getting into. So in court, you asked John to talk about the songs he recorded for that LP and you know, just tell the jury about this and get this out in the trial. Why did you need for him to talk about the songs to the judge? And which ones, you know, stood out to you in the testimony he gave, like Bebopalula, Bring It On Home to Me? Can you tell us about that section of the trial, please?
Well, that part of the trial, we were no longer before the jury. We had a mistrial on the second day of the trial. It started on January 12th, which happened to be my birthday, but I didn't mention it to John because I knew he was not a big fan of celebrating birthdays. But the judge we got to and started the trial on the 14th, which was Wednesday, we both sides agreed to waive the jury. So we had this judge who was only on the bench for a little over 4 years. But it turned out, Bob and Jude, that this judge knew nothing about the Beatles or John Lennon or rock and roll music. And he told us that the afternoon we went down and got set for the trial the next day. And it turned out that he was not only not familiar with rock and roll music, but he was an amateur harpsichordist and a pianist in
This is a family show. Watch your language. I kid.
in an amateur classical musical group. And that led John and I to decide that we were going to give the judge a tutorial about rock and roll music, about John's music, and how he made it. And if you look at the one photo in the book that was taken by Bob Gruen of John on the witness stand one day in January, early in the trial, there's John leaning towards the judge with pointing his finger at the judge, and the judge is sitting there facing him, and John is explaining how he made his albums. And John and Judge Grisey used to have these colloquies where the judge would interrupt whatever was going on, whether Shurtman, Morris Levy's lawyer, was asking questions or whether I was asking questions. And in fact, that photo shows that I'm standing off to the right of the photo at the lectern, and Morris's lawyer, Shurtman, is standing up objecting. And he kept trying to break up these colloquies because he realized that the judge and John were just talking about how John made albums and how important the whole process was to him. And of course, the judge, who told us at one point, "I listen to a lot of music, but I don't know anything about this music. And if you want me to make any decisions about the music, you're going to have to explain it to me." So we actually brought recording equipment from the record plant in, so we could play parts of the songs. I think I got off the subject from your. Oh, I know what you were asking. You were asking
songs. Yeah, the different songs: Bebopalula, Bring It On Home to Me, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, he had reasons for each one of them. Why he picked them? Like Boney Maroney was, and now I'm probably going to not get this right, but it was either Boney Maroney was the song that he played the only night that his mother saw him perform before he died. She taught him how to play Ain't That a Shame on the banjo before he got a guitar. So when we went through, you know, explaining the album and how he picked those songs, he gave a reason for each one of the songs. Yaya, he loved Yaya because he really liked Lee Dorsey. So that helped explain to the judge why he recorded each one of these songs and why he reluctantly, as I explained a few minutes ago, took Angel Baby and Be My Baby off because they sounded terrible and the record would be too long.
Now, the statute of limitations has passed. I seem to have interrupted your answer. I apologize. When I heard the long pause, I thought I would jump in. I was oafish. I jumped in and interrupted you. But is it true that he cut a side deal with the judge to play harpsichord on Double Fantasy and that, like, played into the favorable decision? The time has passed. There's no legal ramifications to this. Is this true?
I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment on that question. Can I claim the Fifth Amendment, please?
You can be the Fifth Beatle, and you can take the Fifth Amendment. There's no problem.
I don't want to incriminate myself.
Well, I just want to stop for a second and say on Bob Wilson's show, if you ask any questions which are a little touchy, it's okay if you answer them, you know. So on that, thank you, John. So we asked that John for that. Did John drop, like, this is a terrible question. But you're talking to John, you're having lunch, you're eating oysters, he's signing autographs for the busboys, you're walking along the streets in New York City. You know, obviously he liked you, you're chummy. So my inappropriate question is, did John ever drop any gossip saying anything about Paul McCartney or the other Beatles or Alan Klein? Did he tell you any anecdotes that were dicey? Because, you know, I know you're not supposed to, but I love that sort of thing.
He didn't. I never asked him what was it like to be the Beatles in 1964. I never asked him any of that. And that, because that wasn't part of why I was there. And that wasn't part of the factual, layout of the case. I can tell you one funny story.
Well, but you were out eating oysters. This isn't during the trial. This is out in the oysters. You're having a couple of gin and tonics, and he's smoking his Gitanes. He didn't come across with any, just a little gossipy story there.
No, but I will.
Almost Paul annoyed him.
Not about the other Beatles, but I will tell you a little gossipy story that about John Eastman, the lawyer whose father was Lee Eastman and whose sister was Linda. Because we were walking up Fifth Avenue one day, and it was one of the days that I attended the deposition that was being taken by Alan Klein's lawyers. And during the course of the day, the dispute between Paul and the other three Beatles about should they use Klein as their manager or Lee Eastman. And, the three Beatles, John, Paul, John, George, and Ringo, and particularly John, they did not like Lee Eastman. And John said to me, did you know Lee Eastman? I said, no, but I know his son, John. And he said, oh, really? And I said, yes, I represented Terry Knight in a dispute between Terry, who was the manager and I guess kind of the founder of Grand Funk Railroad, when they had a parting of the ways. I represented Terry and had dealings with John Eastman. John Eastman was hired by the band, but he was not a trial lawyer or a litigator, so he hired these other lawyers who were a small kind of copyright and trademark firm, but they also did litigation. And I said, let me tell you about this one incident with John Eastman. And here we are, we're walking up Fifth Avenue, a beautiful day in April. And I said, we were having a meeting, the lawyers and John was there. We were having a meeting with the federal magistrate who was supervising all of the pretrial proceedings, the depositions and everything. And during the course of this meeting, and John Eastman didn't used to come to these meetings, but he was at this one. I said something and Eastman lost his temper and he slammed his hand flat down on the table so hard that all
Maxwell's silver hammer?
all of us, yes, like the silver hammer. Although he didn't have a silver hammer, he just had his hand, and everybody jumped. And the magistrate said to him, "You know, what are you doing? What's wrong with you?" And he completely lost his composure, and he then started really pushing towards a settlement. The magistrate did, and he started setting a schedule for the trial. And I said, as a result of John's kind of childish outburst, we did eventually settle the case a couple of months later after a lot of negotiation, but very successfully to Terry Knight. So John says to me, "Oh, that's a good story." He said, "You know, John Eastman was born 40 years old in a dark suit, a white shirt, and a blue tie."
And a pink carnation.
That is hilarious.
Wow.
Well, I've got one for you. I've got one for you. Ask our esteemed guest about his, he is the only person, as far as I know, that ever turned John Lennon down on a dinner invitation.
Well, Jude, you've just sort of, Jude, you have my permission to jump in here in this segment and ask that question because you're an esteemed friend and you're a polished author, so please jump in and ask as you wish. We have plenty of time.
Yeah, tell us that story, Jay.
We had just finished a day in court when we were cross-examining Morris Levy, and he really got all twisted up in his underwear, as the expression goes, and couldn't keep the story straight about whether this was a worldwide deal that he alleged that John had entered into orally, remember? Or was it just limited to the United States or whatever? And the judge started questioning him and actually got Morris to admit that he knew that John, if he was going to do this TV deal, had to get EMI's permission because he, John, and the other Beatles did not have a right to do an album and sell it on a worldwide basis. So we got in the car and we were quite, you know, we got in the limo at the end of the day. And, you know, we were talking about this and how this was a big concession. And I think the judge ended his questioning about that and said, "Well, that ends that," which we all felt meant, well, that's pretty clear that, and there isn't a contract. So we're going uptown and we're talking about that. And as we got closer to our office, John said, this is about 5 o'clock, I guess. And John said, "Well, would you like to have dinner?" And I said, "John, thank you. We really can't, because each day in a trial like this, the court reporters who are taking down the testimony, they keep coming in and out in rotating. And then about 8 o'clock at night, you get the transcript of the day's testimony so you can be ready for the next day's testimony." And what they call it is daily copy. It's mm-hmm. expensive, but you really have to have the daily copy. And I said to him, "John, we really have to go back and wait for this daily copy." And also the judge asked us to put together a number of the times that Morris Levy had claimed in various court documents, including the complaint, that this was a worldwide deal, and he wants us to tell him all of that tomorrow morning. And he said, "Okay, all right, I understand." So we got out of the car and out of the limo, took our bags and everything, and as they drove away, my colleague Howard Roy, who is sitting on the left in the picture in the book of us at Sloppy Louie's, where we had lunch every day, he turns to me and he said, "You just turned down an invitation from John Lennon for dinner." I said to him, I did? And he said, "Yes, you did." And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess I did. But, you know, we got some
unheard
work to do."
Of. Unheard
of. But of course, you know, we had lunch together every day because the first day of the trial, we got into the limo at the lunch break, and I said to John, what do you want to eat? And John said, we're only eating fish. And I said, okay. I tapped the driver on the shoulder, and I said, would you please take us down to where the old Fulton Fish Market is, right on the East River. It wasn't very far from the, just a few blocks from the courthouse. It's not, the Fulton Fish Market isn't there anymore because they gussied up the whole place with something that's called the South Street Seaport. But he pulled, mm-hmm. I knew that there were a number of really good old seafood restaurants there. So he pulled up in front of one of them called Sloppy Louie's. And we got out and went into Sloppy Louie's. It was a very plain, you know, wooden tables, no tablecloths, plastic cups, but the seafood was excellent. And even though nobody said anything after that, every day that they were in court, we went to Sloppy Louie's.
Yeah. Wow. That's just amazing. It's amazing. I mean, I know that it was just part of your daily business, but for those of us who are looking from the outside in, that's pretty incredible.
Well, and, you know, there was only one time that somebody approached John in Sloppy Louie's for an autograph. I mean, and these were all people who worked in the financial district. So, you know, most of the people would recognize who it was, but they left him alone.
Yeah.
They left him alone. Except, and I want to tell Bob this one story about, except for the woman when on the second day of John's deposition, it ended right around the lunch break, and we were walking up the east side of Park Avenue. It was, again, a beautiful day in May. And suddenly this middle-aged woman stopped in front of us and said, you're George Harrison. And John said, yes, I am. Thank you. And she continued walking, and we were walking in the other direction, and the two of us started laughing. But if she had asked him for an autograph, I believe he would have given her an autograph and would have written George Harrison.
Now, that would have been the best one to have. That would have been the coolest.
Yes. Yes. It would have.
Oh, my God.
I might have, you know, kind of chased her back down the street and given her $10 for it.
That would have been super cool to have. Hey, I got to jump in and ask a question that's off the beaten track. Can I go off the beaten track with your permission, counselor?
Sure.
I ask for some Absolutely. Leeway in my testimony. Now, you were in these other cases that you had brought up, and I'm a big fan of the Bob Dylan and his business. You were involved in the case with him and Albert Grossman. Could you tell us a little about that? I find that I didn't know this fact until the show began. Jude teaches me so much. Could you tell us a little bit about that one?
Sure. That was in 19... Let me just stop for a second. I think it was around 1979 or 80.
I was going to guess 1980.
Apparently, Bob's accounting firm, he had a big accounting firm, and he and Albert had made an agreement when they parted ways that Albert would get a cut, some percentage of, I forget what it is now, but a percentage of his income from music publishing and the records. And apparently this had been going on since 66 or 65 or 67, whenever the two of them split up. And the accounting firm said, stop paying him. Just stop. And he did. He stopped paying him. And finally, after a number of either conversations or letters that Albert wrote, he decided to sue. And I got hired to bring the lawsuit. And it was a pretty basic lawsuit because they had a written agreement. And I actually took I took Bob's deposition, and I still have the transcript. And Ooh. By then, I had met several of the musicians that had played, on John's album, because I interviewed them. But one of them, Jim Keltner, the well-known session drummer, had played with Bob on a couple of albums, particularly, I think, a couple of his Christian albums when he went through that Holy Roller period. And Jim and I had gotten friendly. I went to California a couple of times later on after the Lennon case, and we had dinner. So before the deposition started, when I introduced myself to Bob, I said, Jim Keltner's a good friend of mine. And he said, Jim's a good guy. But every question I asked him, his answer ended with, sir. I don't remember that, sir.
I remember one quote from that I had read in an article, and they said something like, I believe he's been paid enough money to this point, sir. So that did stand out in my mind. And I really didn't need to interrupt you for that, but continue.
No, but that I still have the transcript. I'll have to go back and see if I can find that, and I'll send it to you.
Don't toy with me. Don't toy with me, sir. I'm a Bob Dylan file. Like if Chew drives you crazy about John Lennon, you don't know the waters getting into here. So I'll be sending you postcards. Did you find that yet? But please continue.
Well, actually, I got replaced as Albert's lawyer because he claimed that the case was not moving fast enough. And I said, and a lawyer in California who was advising him called me to tell me that. And I said, okay, I'm okay with that. Just pay the bill and I'll turn over the file. And do you both know how Albert died?
No.
I would be guessing, but I don't want to guess about how the man went to the great beyond. Just tell us.
Well,
I don't want to speculate. That'd be rude.
I can tell you how he went to the great beyond. It was not long after he replaced me as the lawyer that Albert every year used to go to a big music publishing conference in on the Riviera in Cannes called MIDEM, M-I-D-E-M. And this particular year, he decided to go over a day early so he could go to London first and watch the Super Bowl. And when they landed in London, the stewardess tried to wake him up, and Albert was dead. He had died in his sleep, flying over.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
Did they
wow.
call you frequent flyer miles for that? Is that like, did you handle litigation for that one?
No.
Well,
we're not
we
paying
are
for the second
time.
Half of the trip.
We are coming up on the end of our show, so I want to ask one more question before we close out, and that is, Jay, you spent so much time in court with John, and all of those months that you were together at lunch, also you met several times in the Dakota, at your office. At the end of it all, when all was said and done, what was your final impression of John Lennon? How did you feel about him?
John Lennon was, when I knew him, was happy. He was chilled out. I think he was very pleased with where his life was at that point. He was looking forward to his role in the trial ending, so he could go back and spend time taking care of Sean. And he was really looking forward to that a lot. He talked about that before the trial started, because Sean was born, as I said, in October of 75. And the day he was finished, that was it. He didn't even come to the oral argument the next day on the counterclaims. he said, that's it. I've had it. I don't want to listen to any more of Morris Levy's lies through his lawyer. And I think he was, I think he was profoundly happy. You know, I never saw him. I never saw him smoke a cigarette. I know he was apparently a heavy smoker, but I mean, we were out in a number of places where he could have smoked, restaurants or, you know, in the limo or walking down Park Avenue, whatever. Never saw him smoke. Never heard him use bad language. He was just trying to be a normal person, and he was being a normal person.
Right.
I think I told the story in the book about how we were driving down one day to court, and he asked me and Harold Roy, who was with me, did we know some group called Queen? And and we looked at each other and said, yeah, we know Queen. And he said, they've got this lead singer? I said, yes, they have a lead singer. And he said, well, Julian, whenever I talk to him on the phone now, and I guess Julian was now about, I don't know, 11 or 12.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. He said, Julian starts talking about this group Queen and this singer. And he said, I guess I'm really going to have to do some studying to find out who this group is. And, you know, that I thought was a classic example or exhibit A, really, to how he had dropped out of the music business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was just,
like every other dad. He had to keep up like every other dad, you know?
Yes. Yeah, he had to.
I love that. I love that. I love it. Well, we cannot tell you thank you enough for being with us, Jay. I know you have been on so many. You've been all over the U.S. talking about your book. You and I met up at the Chicago Fest for Beatles fans, and then you went straight to New York and spoke up there, and you've been on many, many podcasts. So thank you for the gift of your time to be with Bob and with me today. We do appreciate it very much.
Yes, we do.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Jude, and inviting and introducing me to Bob. I really appreciated it, particularly.
You'll forgive her for that in one time.
His wonderful accent, I love talking about this book because I really want as many people to read it, to learn about this very interesting and previously hidden part of John's life.
It is an excellent, excellent book. And I probably have 500 books or more on John and the Beatles. And this is my going on my 36th year of doing research on John. And
you're only 34 years old. How did you manage that?
God bless you, Bob. You're my favorite friend. But I really cannot say enough good about it. People are going to be fascinated with it. It is, I mean, there are not very many books I've listened to three times and read twice. So it's so excellent. And Bob, if you don't mind, may I plug our upcoming webinar?
Well, I was going to ask you about it, Jude.
We are.
Of course you can. You have so many hit books in a webinar. Please tell us about how people can sign up for it. We'd love to hear it.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. On the 4th of October, just a little bit before John's birthday, on the 9th, Jay is going to be on the combined effort of our She Said, She Said podcast and the Focal Points webinar. Lena Sag and I will be hosting him live and in person at 7:30 p.m. Central, and it will be an evening with Jay Bergen. People want to sign up, it's free. You just have to register. It's going to be video Zoom, so people will get to see Jay, and they'll also have the opportunity to ask him questions at the end of the program. So we can only have 100 people, and we've got a little bit more than half signed up right now, and usually the last week we have a lot of people sign up, but it's free. Just go to the Jude Sutherland Kessler Facebook page and sign up for it, and we hope that a lot of people can be there to hear this story in person. So thank you, Bob, for letting me say that.
I wouldn't have it any other way. And we have a special shout out to go out today. This is John Lennon coming back, and I just want to say that we'd like to give a big shout out to the recuperating Mr. Warren Brown of Tomorrow Never Knows, and we hope that he's having a great day. And back to Bob. Now, I know Jude didn't want to sing, so usually we sing out, we'll do like a little Beatles song there. So since Jude didn't want to sing, and, we'll let her off the hook. So we're going to do a non sequitur. Does everybody love a non sequitur? So as we fade out, give the two of you great thanks. So I'm going to sing the Carol Burnett closing song. Did you ever see with Harvey Korman and Steve Lawrence and Tim Conway and Vicki Lawrence? She had a little song she'd sing. So Jude's not uncomfortable. We won't sing out with a Beatles song. So I'm so glad we had this time together. Just to have sing along, Jay. Just to have a laugh or sing a song is enough line. Just to have a laugh or sing a song. Jay, it seems we just get started, then before you know it. Seems we just get started, Jay, and before you know it, go ahead.
Seems we just be started.
Comes the time we have to say, take it, Jay.
So long!
We have to say, so long. I'm pulling on my ear like she used to do.
Oh, I love it.
Well, that's really cool. So the book is Lennon, the Mobster, and the Lawyer. And Jude, tell us about your many books. You have like about how many of the nine are written so far?
We are up to volume 5, part 1. And I'm working on part 2 moments away from now. So,
did you pick 9 books because John loved the number 9, or was there another reason?
That's the one and only reason.
Well, that's a good reason. Thank you two for being here. I hope you two might come back.
Anytime you want us to come back. I'm ready.
We would love to have you back on. So we'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and we hope we've passed the audition. And welcome back. Welcome back. Just take a look at that Shake and Bake Network. I couldn't have butchered that any worse than the Yesterday and Today cover. So anyway, look at the Shake and Bake Network. Go look for those books, and we thank our guests from the bottom of our heart, and thanks to our producer, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you so much.